This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan and Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com.
E-scouting is the crucial first step to any great adventure, but sometimes we gotta swap the muck boots for flip-flops and the shotguns for fishing rods and get out on the water to recharge those batteries. Whether you're in search of the lunker that broke you off last summer or trying to get the family out for a day on the water, you need to have a game plan. That's where Onyx Fish comes into play. With detailed bathymetry maps, expert information, historical fisheries data, and filters that allow you to hone in on your next favorite lake for a multitude of species, this is an angler's best friend. Shoot, I'm actually planning a father-son trip to the North Woods with some buddies right now, and I already feel like I've got a game plan in place to catch more fish than the rest of those guys. And the best part is, it's easy, intuitive, and based on the same platform as our beloved Onyx Hunt app. Go check it out today and start finding your next honey hole at onyxmaps.com/fish.
Turkey season is here, and when it comes time to hit the woods and chase some gobbles, you need gear that's as ready to hunt as you are. That's why I'm proud to be partnered with Huntworth Gear. This spring, I'll be running around the woods in the Durham lightweight pants, which have been my go-to pants for everything the last couple of years. They've got a waterproof seat and knee panels that keep you dry when setting up, and breathable, quick-drying fabric to keep you comfortable after a long walk through tall, dewy grass, or when you're putting on the miles looking for that lonely long beard. On top, I'll be wearing the Grayling Heat Boost hoodie if it's cold and the Camden lightweight hoodie when it's hot. And don't forget the Ames lightweight gloves with fingerless index and thumb holes that give you the dexterity you need to run those calls unimpeded all season long. Go build your kit out today at huntworthgear.com or visit the hunting section of your local farm and fleet or fleet farm to find it in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies. And one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or just looking to get out and try something new. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com.
If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd even venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about in this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice to hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved works their tails off to protect public lands and access those public lands and waters.
To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what we have going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, hope you're all doing well. I hope you all had a fantastic 4th of July. I hope you're listening with all your fingers and toes and just had an awesome weekend getting outside, hopefully, spending time with folks that you like, and just had a great weekend all around. Weather was finally nice. Really glad that the 90 degree heat wave we had during the week decided to lay off for the weekend for us there. But folks, we are officially into July, which means a lot of things. I know a lot of guys I saw were getting trail cams out. They were starting to clean out the water holes, trying to get the food plot stuff started, and really just made the full shift into deer mode. And I'm getting there, but I'm not quite there yet, because there's still a lot of really good fishing to be had, specifically in the bass world. The warm water fishing, oftentimes, I mean, July, just there's something about it that kind of, when I think of that month, I think of sweating my butt off, hanging trail cameras, and I think about frogging for largemouth. Like, those are the two of those things just kind of define July for me. But, you know, I'm not the best bass angler. I'm decent, but I don't know nearly as much as I would like to, as I would like to. Luckily, I was very fortunate to cross paths back in February at a speaking event. I crossed paths with the one and only Jim Crowley. Now, Jim is a guy who just has a plethora of knowledge in the bass world. He's an Illinois guy, but he's been fishing professionally for the last, I believe he says, 33, 34 years. So he's got some experience. He knows a thing or two about chasing largemouth and smallmouth bass. And so I wanted to get him on to really just dive into how can we capitalize on the dog days of summer when it kind of sucks to do anything but fish, and put more fish in the boat and have a lot more fun and just maximize this summer. So we cover a ton of stuff in this episode. We hear about how Jim got into the tournament bass fishing scene, and then how that eventually led into him starting Jim Crowley Outdoors, which is his TV show, which you can find on a multitude of platforms. He also hosts Wired to Fish TV, and he also has his own podcast, Slick Fish Radio. All of those are going to be linked down in the show notes here. But we dive into really what his career path looked like. We dive into some essential boat electronics and what things are actually worthwhile to have on your boat and to put your money into. We talk about how he uses Onyx Fish and all of the travel that he does for all of his shows and everything, and just what an invaluable tool that is. We talk about determining the forage base of a fishery, three lure setups that he's always got rigged up in his boat, the difference between structure and cover, and learning how bass move around a lake during the day, which honestly, especially if you're a deer-minded individual, that one was a massive light bulb moment for me, because I guess I'd never really thought about it in terms of what bass are doing throughout the day. I think I always looked at it as like, well, they like to tuck up underneath the dock, or they like to hang out by the rock pile or the weed line or whatever it may be. But I was unaware that they have kind of like a bed to feed pattern, almost very similar to whitetails. And if you play your cards right, Jim dives into how you can capitalize on that. And so that was super cool. We just cover a ton of awesome, awesome information. This was an absolutely delightful conversation that I had with Jim. I'm super appreciative of him for taking time to come on the show. And I don't think this will be the last time we hear from Jim, because he is just a wealth of knowledge and fantastic guy to shoot the breeze with. And so I'm going to wrap this intro up. Before I do that, though, be sure to mark your calendars for Wednesday, August 12th, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m.
at the Great Dane in Fitchburg, we will be hosting our Wisconsin deer season kickoff presented by Onyx Hunt. It is going to be an absolute blast. There will be e-scouting presentations from myself, Derek Malcor, Jacob Sklenner, and Paul Anir, as well as some awesome raffle prizes, great Q&A session, and a bunch of free food and free beer. So, hey, come on out. Mark your calendars for that. Still working on the RSVP link. Bear with me. It'll be on social media here or in the show notes coming up in future episodes as soon as I get it. But huge thanks to Jim. Huge thanks to all you guys for listening. And enjoy this episode, folks. We will talk to you next Tuesday. Thanks, guys. All right, Jonah, man, this week's episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman, I have Mr. Jim Crowley. Jim, how are we doing today?
Great, man. Thanks for having me on, Pierce. I was looking forward to this, buddy. So yeah. Thanks for having me.
Likewise, man. Likewise. It has been, like we were just talking off air, it has been a fantastic spring for harassing bass. And it seems like it's kind of just continuing on that same trajectory right now as we head into the summer here. But you just got back from up north. How are things fishing up there?
It was great. As we were talking a little bit before, we've been filming at Mille Lacs for different shows that I've hosted over the years, probably 12, 13 years now, I think, mm-hmm. And we've had some really, really good outings there. But this year was incredible. We filmed 4 shows in 5 days. And I mean, 4 complete shows. Smallmouth were extremely cooperative and sizes and numbers that I haven't seen in a while. And I know it's not just me because I've been seeing a lot of reports from that area. It's been a really, really good spring for smallmouth. We went into Ontario after that, and it was absolutely no different. We had to change tactics a little bit because the fish were just in a different phase of, I'm going to call it pre-spawn, because as mm-hmm. you said, it was so drawn out. But once we figured it out and dialed it in, again, it was pretty, pretty incredible. And it's been a great spring. We're into, July now, and we're almost done filming for the whole season. We've only got about 2 or 3 holy episodes smokes. Left. It had me with a lot of editing and a lot of headaches, but you know what? I've had it the other way where you're struggling, to put together a season. And so this was just fun. We've had a lot of big fish this year, a lot of fish. And I think for this season and next season, viewers are going to get some really educational shows that we did. And I'm looking forward to hearing how they feel about it because we had a blast.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, you've kind of touched on it there. You are the host of Jim Crowley Outdoors. You've got the Wired to Fish podcast. You've been in the outdoor media and in the fishing space for quite a while, man. You've got a long resume there. Can you tell us a little bit about kind of how you got started in that, where you're from, what all you do, and just tell us a little bit about Jim Crowley here.
Sure. I think it's been, 33, 34 years I've been in the industry now. I can't believe it's been that long. I had a full-time job too, but I started tournament fishing at the age of 23, and I was fortunate enough to have some local and regional success. And then I ended up getting into television with a show that most of everybody knows, Midwest Outdoors Magazine.
Yeah.
And I started with them back in the late 90s. And I was very fortunate, learned a lot about television from them. I went everywhere from Mexico to numerous places in Canada and numerous lodges throughout Canada, writing for them as well as hosting and co-hosting episodes with them. And then probably around 2009 or 10, I started doing a YouTube thing right when it came out, and we started doing a show that way. And then it's probably close to about 6 years ago now, Wired to Fish licensed their name to a streaming station, and then it became Wired to Fish TV. And that was probably one, maybe not the first, but one of the ones where they started branching off onto multiple platforms. So if you can be seen on Wired to Fish TV, you can actually be seen on 12 different things now, like Net or like Plex and Sling and things like that. And so that really broadened our fishing show out a lot. And then I started my podcast, which is Slick Fish Radio. They took that on as well. And so it branched off there, the Roku, Fire TV, Amazon Music, iTunes, and Spotify. And then in this past January, we started with Outdoor Action TV as well as Pursuit Up, which basically now if you have a television, you can get Jim Crowley Outdoors. So it's been, I've always said that God has blessed me with an incredible ride. I've met some absolutely amazing people, and I've got to do what I love to do, and that's fish. And I've always said, I don't care if people agree with me or disagree with me. All I care about is they catch more fish because of it. And we've had a heck of a ride, and I don't plan on slowing down anytime soon.
That's fantastic, man. I love that. I don't care if they agree or disagree, as long as they catch more fish.
So all I care about is if they is if they catch fish. That, you know what? I've told people for years, there's all my social media channels, there's only three things we discuss on my social media channels. It's rod building, lure making, and God. If those are not three of your things, you probably don't need to be on my pages. Mm-hmm. Otherwise than that, we that's what we like to talk about. That's what we like to discuss, and we're having a great time doing it. So I hope people are enjoying the ride.
That's fantastic, man. I love that. That's really, really cool. And so you're a Midwest guy, right?
Yeah. So I'm in Illinois. Okay. Yep. So I was born and raised in Chicago. I survived that. And I moved to the middle of the state in a little tiny town called Hayworth. That's where I live now. Only about 3,000 people. And I've always said the difference between like Chicago and Hayworth is both places they wave when they see a Hayworth, they just do it with their whole hand. Or Chicago, they do it with one finger.
Yeah, I love that. That's awesome. That's interesting because they, you know, growing up in the Chicagoland area, you know, it's a more urban area, obviously. Sure. What was your introduction to fishing like? Like what kind of got you hooked?
Oh, great. My dad. My dad, and he started me in the boat when I was 3 years old. And the story, as he used to tell me, goes, by the time I was 4 or 5, he didn't have to bring any toys in the boat anymore. All I wanted to do was fish. Yeah. And I lived in the northwest side of Chicago. This is a true story. So my dad would work 5 days a week, and he had to drive about 1.5 to 2 hours of work every day. Just nuts because of the traffic, right? So he'd come home, and on Sunday morning was when he could go fishing. So he would take me to Lake Geneva most of the time and fish in Williams Bay there and be at home before 11 o'clock so he could go to mass with mom and me. So he would, and then what he would do is he would take me out of school in the spring and the fall and take me fishing with his buddies. And so I grew up around a lot of older guys. So I learned respect as a young man. I had to, or I wouldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. He would have taken me out. So he always said, he goes, you can go along as you respect these men that are my friends. And he made it very, very clear to me. And I think I actually learned a lot about communication and talking to older people at a much younger age. And I think as I grew, that definitely made me feel more uncomfortable in front of crowds, more comfortable doing things like this, because we had conversations just like you and I are having. Mm-hmm. You know, it was great. I never knew it was going to lead to all of this, but I look back on it now and I'm very thankful that I got the opportunity to do all of that.
Definitely. That's such a cool story. And I haven't really thought of it in that regard of just that exposure at a young age and being like what that really does for you. I think so often we think about it in terms of like, oh, I was this young when I started going to fish camp or up to deer camp or, you know, whatever hunt camp or fish camp that you went to and everything. We think about it in terms of learning the skills and learning the, the art of fishing for bass or a specific species or hunting in a certain way. But there's so much more to it. I really love that you hit on that, that it helps develop you just as an individual being exposed to that and like having to have those conversations, like you said, with folks who are your dad's age and, you know, bridging that gap of it's not just, Mr. Smith and Mr. Johnson or whatever that are along with the trip, but it's also like they're not just your dad's friends. As you bridge that gap, they become your friends too. It's super cool.
Well, you're 100% right, because one of them still, the last of my dad's friends that is living, I just talked to him for his 80th birthday about a week or so ago, Larry, and about at least once a year, I try to take him fishing somewhere, and it's getting a little bit harder because he's getting older, but we've remained friends after my dad passed. And, you know, it is that tie back, the only tie back I really have left to, you know, my dad. So when he's in the boat and I catch a fish or he catches a fish, it takes us both back to when we were doing it with my dad, because they were such close friends and they worked together for a long time. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Super cool. Yeah. Talk to me. So like we're coming up as we record this, Father's Day is this upcoming Sunday and everything. Talk to me a little bit about sort of the transition or whatever as you kind of developed and continued to really dive into bass fishing and angling as a whole? You reach that point as fathers and sons do, or you know, mothers and sons or whoever's fishing, where you kind of start to get neck and neck, and then eventually the young buck kind of passes. What did that look like for you guys?
It was pretty funny. I kind of remember actually when that happened. And I will tell you this, I've never been asked that question before. Excellent question. Because it just made me flash back to we were on, and it was Wisconsin. It was Lost Land, Ghost, and Teal Lakes in northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I had just started tournament fishing. I was still pretty young, like 21, 22, somewhere around there. And I went on a fall trip with my dad and his buddies. I was working then, so I took the week off work and went up there with him. And we get to this creek mouth. And I'm like, hey, this ought to be a pretty good spot for largemouth. And my dad's like, well, you know, we haven't caught that many here. I proceed to throw a spinner bait and put like 18 fish in a boat or something goofy like that. And my dad's looking at me going like, what are you doing? You know, and he's like, how did you, why? And I'm like, well, they should be here. You know, they should be here. There's running water and, you know, there were fronts and it was turnover, blah, 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 kind of stuff. But running water always negates that. I said, so I wanted to find some running water. And he's like, well, how did you know that? I go, I learned that last year when I started tournament fishing, but from a guy, you know, and that's what I think my dad started seeing that, you know, and then 3 or 4 years later, you know, I was on television for the first time. And then my mom said he would get up on Sunday morning and watch Midwest Outdoors. And she goes, they'd see who the episodes were. And if you weren't on there, he's like, I'm watching something else, you know? So, but yeah, it was just funny. But I think that was a moment when he kind of realized that, hey, you know, maybe all this work I put in with this yo-yo kid of mine is actually paying off. That's when I think it happened.
That's super cool. What an awesome story. Yeah. It's kind of that one moment where you don't want to admit that, like, son of a gun, I didn't think about that. You're right. Yeah. Like, yeah, I never would have caught that. Darn. That's super cool. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, kind of on that note there, in that vein of when you get into tournament fishing and stuff, did you have any mentors that you really learned a ton from? Or was it just kind of it's like anything, right? You surround yourself with people who are hopefully better than you so that you can continue to improve and learn and everything.
What were those
early days of tournament like?
Yeah, no question about that at all. I was very lucky. I fished back in those days. There was a lot of bass clubs with, not like bass clubs are today, but these guys were, you know, go out and have a tournaments and there'd be 20, 30 boats in those little club tournaments, right? Mm-hmm. And so a couple of guys back then, one by the name of Ronnie Long, was older than me, and we became quite good friends for a while, but he kind of took me under his wing and showed me seasonal patterns. And I learned about why bass should be, you know, what we thought about that all before forward-facing sonar and all that. And so what we learned about where bass should be. And then one of the staunchest competitors back in the day, back there, the Bloomington Road Bass Club probably produced more guys out of Illinois that went regionally, and qualified for some of the bigger things and national type things than anywhere else in the state at that time. And that club is actually still around. Another gentleman by the name of Joe Snyder, who was absolutely one of the most incredible tournament anglers when I was in my 20s that I'd ever seen. And I learned a lot from those guys. And there was a lot of those guys in that club that were older than me. They teach you, you know, they would help you a little bit until you started winning and doing well. And then it got kind of tight-lipped, you know, it got kind of tight-lipped. But I would still look back and all that and say, all those gentlemen made me become better because then I was very competitive. I just was. I used to be in martial arts before that. I was a black belt in Taekwondo and I was very competitive anyway. And so now to be put at something like that, and I like to win. And I know obviously you don't do that every time you go out, but I still have the same attitude when I go out and film a show. I want to figure out what's going on. I want to win the day. And even if it's in my mind, you know, how can I be doing something better? How can I be more efficient? How can I do this? And I learned that back from those early days of being able to see something and try to, once you get that clue of what's going on, and try to be able to expand on that and then to be able to adjust when that changes. And I learned that started to learn that way back when I was in my 20s, thanks to some of those older gentlemen who decided to give me an insight of what how they've been catching fish.
Sure. Was there ever a point in those early days where you kind of, you know, you have that transition from I'm going out to fish to have fun. Mm-hmm. Now I'm entering tournaments where there's, you know, maybe some cash on the line here, or, you know, I've, at the very least, I've sunk some money into this to get the boat there, to travel to this lake, sure, to do all this stuff, to get into the tournament. Was there a point where it started to feel a little bit more pressure in
yes,
sort of a negative way, where it was kind of like, you know, we're like, we're almost fishing for work here? And yeah, how did you kind of reconcile with that?
Because of, you know, I had a really good reputation for being consistent. Mm-hmm. I obviously had some wins, but then I was very fortunate to cash a good number of checks. Doesn't matter if it's a Tuesday night or a Thursday night, or $50, $100, $500, whatever. But then you started feeling like you had to do that all the time. And after about 13 years of that, I remember in the BFLs, when the BFLs were getting real big, I finished fourth in the state 1 year, finished and missed going to the All-American by one fish. But yeah, I know, by one fish. And I finished at the regional that year, I finished the highest as a person in Illinois. And when you come into the weigh-in and people are telling you, you got it, you hear them read it off and you miss it by one fish. I mean, one 12-inch fish is what I missed it by. I had hit my period of burnout, I think, right after that. And I was very grateful at that time that I had some television offers, you know, coming in about being on, you know, local and regional television shows. And then Midwest mm-hmm. Outdoors gave me the opportunity to travel. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I'm going to miss this tournament. And I'm like, am I going to go back to Lake Shelbyville again and hope for two or three bites? Or now I've got the opportunity to go to Canada and broaden my horizons on fishing for a lot of different species of fish and learning more about those. And I'm very grateful that I went. You know, I think that's where God went, here's a wall. That's where I'm stopping you. I need you to go in this direction, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the direction I went then, is television. And I'm forever grateful that, you know, that at the time I wasn't the only tournament I ever cried at. But I was very grateful that that's a turn that it took, because it meant a whole, you know, a whole different life for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's super cool. And I'm like, yeah, I'm grateful for you that was the the pivot that you, or the door that opened for you at that moment there as well. That's really cool. You obviously, you mentioned you've been in the industry and like fishing for bass, you know, well beyond just, you know, the 32, 33 years that you mentioned yep. there. You've seen a lot of technological advancements.
Yeah.
In terms of the electronics, obviously forward facing sonar. I'm only asking that because you just mentioned it there.
Sure, sure.
In terms of, I guess, how do I phrase this here? I'm trying to think of which way I don't want to load it too much. in terms of technology continuing to emerge and improve mm-hmm. over the course of your career, what stuff, is there anything that you found is not worth the while, like not worth the investment? Is there anything that like encourages you in a way that like gets you excited about the direction that things are going?
Yeah. You know, when, and especially, when it comes to electronics, when I first started, I learned a lot of stuff by instinct, which is how a lot of older guys did it back mm-hmm. then. Right. And so I never had the real fancy graph shop. I was pretty happy with a flasher showing me the change in the bottom, you know, and the flasher came along. And then, I think if I look back, I wish I would have got more into side scan when it first came out, because that can be so beneficial to people. But I've been asked this question, or a question like this before, and I'm going to rephrase it, and then I'm going to go back to what you were saying. Yeah. The most successful piece of equipment, I think, that I feel that I could not live without in my boat when it comes to electronics, is Spot Lock.
I love that answer.
Absolutely is 100% is Spot Lock. You could take all my electronics away, as much as I love them, especially some of the new stuff. It's so cool, but you could take everything away, but you better keep my Spot Lock.
Mm-hmm.
I got to have that. That has made more of a difference than everything else in electronics for me, is being able to hold on a spot. And I had an old tracker way back when that first came out, And I remember the first time I used it on the show that we were filming, and stayed off a log about 20 yards and pulled 8 fish off that log on a windy day when there's no way I could have done that. No way I could have done that without Spotlock. And it has been extremely beneficial to me. So they can have all, and I love all the electronics. I don't really have an electronic sponsor. I use all Humminbird stuff. The new Humminbird Explore units, I think, are easier than any electronics that I've ever used. And I really, really like them because I'll be honest, I'm not the greatest guy out there with electronics, but it's made it a lot easier to do things, to find things. And the Mega Live 2 has been a ball, not so much for catching fish on it as is being able to find cover away from what you were originally fishing.
For sure.
And like if I'm fishing a weed line, I'm always scanning out to see if I can find a weed clump or another rock or something. And I may not see the fish there, but a lot of times if I find it, dropping a drop shot or dropping a jig down there, I'm gonna get bit. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think that thing has been so beneficial for is literally being able to find bait, pods of bait. That has been more beneficial to me to know for sure that I'm 100% in the right area and making me more efficient. Not that I always see the fish and catch it, but knowing that I have the opportunity to do so, then I stop watching that screen and start concentrating on what I'm doing.
Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode.
Sure. Absolutely. When you're I haven't used a sophisticated enough electronic to be able to actually identify a bait in there. Like, and if you can paint a picture for me, like, what is that look for or look like on those screens? Is it just you can see the rock or the log or whatever?
A lot of times I can see literally a moving ball above something and see the fish, you know, below it. I've literally seen it before where I've seen smallmouth coming in and out and diving inside. I couldn't catch them, but they were feeding like crazy. I've always said this is what forward-facing sonar is great for, is proving to you that you don't know everything, because there are a lot more fish that ignore your stuff than they do hit it. I can just, at least on my experience anyway. But it's been really, really cool for that. The other thing is when you dial the stuff in, and I think the Mega Live is easy to do that, I've seen the thermocline, which is pretty cool. There. Yeah. And I've also seen algae blooms where you can see how far the algae bloom goes down in the water. And that has made me adjust my lure presentation. And that has been some really, really cool stuff. And, you know, and I've heard, even when I've done interviews with people and you've heard people go, hey, well, you know, it's cheating. It's a cheater box. Okay. I got news for you. Why don't you go out there and you turn that thing on and see if you catch a fish right away? Those young kids who are doing that, a lot of them, they have to know how to find fish to know how to do it, because I know how to find fish. I still all the time cannot catch the ones that I see on there. So as far as I'm concerned, they're using what they grew up on with. They have more access to information now than we ever had. Times are changing. In my opinion, you have more intelligent fishing pressure out there now than you ever have been. That's not going to stop. So as an angler, what you've got to do, no matter how old you are, is you have to learn to be more precise with your presentations. You have to understand what your lure is doing on every cast, and you better be paying attention. Because if you're not, somebody else is.
Mm-hmm. 100%. I couldn't agree more with that. And especially like you said, like, oh, people think you can slap a forward-facing sonar on the front of the boat, and they're just gonna be able to go out there and pound fish.
No,
like you still have to know where to go. You can just throw it on there, and you might eventually find some. But if you're just gonna grid search a lake until you figure out what's going on, like, you have to have some background knowledge going into that. You have to know. And even so, it's like, okay, if we see that rock pile and it's in 24 feet of water, and you're throwing an X-Rap or something like that, or a stick bait that's, you know, buzzing over its head 20 feet, like, good luck. It's that rock means nothing down there at that point. So yeah, that's, I like that a lot. That's a really great point. On the note of electronics and, you know, just technology and everything, looking at your shirt there, you've got Onyx Fish. They're a partner of your show, partner of this show as well.
Yeah.
How have you started to use Onyx as or Onyx Fish, and how has that changed your approach?
Oh yeah, a lot. And let's put it this way. So I had an Android, so I was using it. I have an Android, so I was using it on my computer that I'm talking to you on right now. And so this is, and I've tried other apps, and this is before I started working with Onyx. I bought the subscription to this, and I went, this is easy. The cool thing was, when I pulled up the lake, that filtering system they have in the upper left-hand corner right there, when you can click on and say species of fish, search this area, bam, and it pulls it up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see abundance of fish. You can see trophy size potential. I was able to knock out lakes in Minnesota around where we were fishing at Mille Lacs. I love fishing lakes that have both largemouth and smallmouth in them, because I think it's fun. I think it's fun for the viewer, because sometimes you get into both of them, right? Yep. And it's fun. And so we found that. Boom, I found my exit, or I found my boat ramps on tiny little lakes that, and you know, some of those ramps, just like in Wisconsin, if you don't know where that boat ramp is, there's a reason for that. They don't want you finding that.
Yep.
Right? And there may be a boat ramp there that holds like four boats. You know, it's public access, but that's all it may hold. And so I love finding those little bodies of water and then go explore. And now an Onyx made that so much easier to do my homework before I ever left the house. You know, I wasn't asking at the tackle store, hey, is there any good lakes around here? I mean, I still do. I love asking for local information. But now I already had a game plan by Onyx to lakes that I was going to consider, because these already had what I was looking for. This made my time, actually, that it was going to be on the water, a lot more efficient, because I wasn't looking for these lakes when I got there. I found them. I was on the X before I went.
Absolutely.
And now I love, with the weather pattern stuff on there, where I can tell wind, and now I look at it in the morning before we go out. It just, everything is in one app, and it makes it, it just makes it so much easier. And I mean, those guys have it dialed in. I mean, Onyx has it dialed in, period, with everything they do, whether it be hunting or anything else. But when Onyx Fish, and especially when you can use it in Illinois here, I've even used it on lakes that I've went to before and go, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. And what the thing I like about it the most is, it's not, you're not getting where Uncle Fred caught two bass the other day, you know, and that's where they put a mark. This is fisheries information. This is legitimate biology backed up with study that this is a stocking program. This is, and it's as recent as it gets. And everything like that, I said, in one app. And for a guy like me, if I can use it, folks, anybody out there can use this thing. I'm telling you, if I can do it, so can you. And it's a great app. It's just a fantastic app.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's, well, like you said, it's intuitive. It's so simple, and you've got everything right there. And I mean, we planned my most recent trip up north. We planned that back in January, February, started doing that. And I started picking around and Onyx Fish. And so for months, I've just been like scouring this thing and this whole area, and being able to look at, I love the comparison of how this lake stacks up compared to the state average. And you get that like above, or like trophy potential, or the outlier abundance or whatever for different species and everything. And so you can key in on that kind of stuff and see how it compares to neighboring lakes and really develop a plan. Not to mention the detailed descriptions of what the structure looks like along the shore. And how some of them have the fishing hotspots, some of them don't, but most of them still have some data in there that says like, oh, this back bay over here is muck, or it's, you know, submerged vegetation, or it's rocks or boulders or riprap or whatever it may be. It is fantastic. Like, that absolutely saved the planning of our fishing trip, and just like helped us. Cause really, I mean, my buddies who just bought the place up there, they'd only fished a handful of times. And so to be able to go in and say like, well, just from what I've seen so far, these little points back here, these islands in here, that little creek mouth there, like it says that should be pretty good. Let's start there and then we'll branch out. And once we kind of see whether or not there's any validity to that, and then boom, we all come back and meet for lunch and everybody had a great morning. And it was in large part to that.
You know, the other thing that I use it for, and maybe you've done this, and just for your listeners and viewers to think about this, is that I also go on the Onyx app, and when you're looking at the abundance, you're looking at fish species that are in each lake, whatever I'm fishing for, largemouth or smallmouth, and obviously you could do this for walleyes as well, but I'm starting to look, what are some of the other fish in here? So am I seeing a high abundance of bluegills? Am I seeing a high abundance of perch? Because then I start thinking, okay, what are these largemouth and smallmouth feeding on?
For sure.
And if there's a higher abundance of perch on there, I may match some of my lures accordingly because I'm going, you know what? I'm going to put the, remember, fishing is, always has been, always will be a game of odds, right? Mm-hmm. So the more odds you put in your favor, the better off your chances for success. So if I got a higher abundance of perch on this, as I'm reading on the Onyx app, I'm going to start taking some of those lures and going, maybe I should try some perch colors or some perch shapes. You know, if it's bluegills, and maybe it's a lake that's all largemouth, there's a lot more bluegills in here, maybe I'm going to start tailoring my swim jigs or my bladed jigs to look more like bluegills. And before we couldn't do that. We had to go and actually see. Now I get an idea of what, because to me, especially northern lakes, forage base is extremely important, especially in clear bodies of water. And I want to know what the forage base is of the fish that I'm pursuing, whether it be northern pike, largemouth, smallmouth, whatever. I want to know what they're feeding on, because if I can figure out what they're feeding on, I got a better chance of matching my lures to hopefully catch some of those fish, trying to match their forage.
Absolutely. I love that. I hadn't thought about that in terms of looking at using Onyx fish for the abundance of potential bait fish there. On that note, when you're going up to some of these lakes and everything, like I do much more river fishing than I do lake fishing. So like I spend a lot of time in the lower Wisconsin River, big emerald shiner and shad fishery in there. We get a big hatch that's going on right now. I'm waiting for the river to drop so that fish can get back to crashing on bait and everything. But when you're going up north and you're looking at other stuff, trying to assess what the primary food sources and forage is up there, how do you go about doing that? Are you looking at what's the habitat like in there? Are you looking at fisheries data? Like, how do you establish whether or not it's a shad fishery or a smelt or you know, any sort of forage like that? What do you look for in there?
Data is one of them. And so I'll give you recent example I can give you is when we went up to Canada here. We were fishing for smallmouth, and we were fishing on a place called Calm Lake. And just looking at, you know, they had perch in there and have other stuff, and that's typical smallmouth stuff and some other minnows and everything. But one thing that I found out through the owner that these fish really key in on, and I mean, you could tell they keyed in on them. Well, let me tell you the fish first. It was Cisco's. Okay. And these are kind of a bluish, silvery, whitish fish. Well, he was telling me stories about in the summertime, they will gang up on certain points and they will crash the Cisco's at the surface. And it, to me, it, and these fish get square. I actually made a comment in one of the episodes we filmed this. I'm like, this fish is almost as square as it is long. I mean, they were so bulky. I mean, they're just solid. And I go, I attribute that to a lot of their diet. It's because of those Cisco's. Another example, when we used to go film up in northern Manitoba, we used to fish a little Churchill River system, and the pike there would get huge. They'd get, I mean, thick, heavy, heavy. Well, one of the things that's in that river system is burbot. And since there's no lake trout in that system, who's feeding on the burbot? A greasy, oily, high protein fish, those pike. That's why they get so big. So a lot of our bucktails were brown and white.
Sure.
And we would catch, you know, 45s, 46s, big pike, right? 45, 46 inch pike on these brown and white bucktails or brown and white jerkbaits or anything with a dark back and a white belly. Well, you're matching one of their preferred, you know, yeah, they're going to feed on walleyes. Yeah, they're going to feed on perch. But if they got a chance to get a burbot, I guarantee you they're going to go after it. It's like a smallmouth. What's he going to go after? Probably it's a crayfish, right? That's a very high protein thing for them. But what else are they going to be doing? If they're looking up, they're going after those. If they're not on the bottom and they're looking up, they're probably going to be wanting to try those Ciscos. So with that being said, one of our most popular baits on the last trip was I throw this little teeny tiny bladed jig that we make. One of the companies I work for is Lure Parts Online. And the reason I'm throwing a name in there is because they make a small little tiny blade that you can make miniature bladed jigs with. For some of your listeners might know as a chatterbait, like a really small one. It only gets about 3 inches long, not even. And I would make this with a blue and white skirt. When those smallmouth would hit it, they would about rip the rod out of your hand. And if there was any breeze blowing that day at all, we would pick up and throw that bladed jig. And I had skirt strands coming off by the end of the day. They annihilated it. When it was dead calm, then we were throwing a black hair, just a black hair jig, but it had a little bit of silver and blue tinseling. Whether they thought it was a mayfly, whether they thought it was a whatever, but those two baits, but one of them for sure was at least closely identified to those Ciscos, and it paid off for us. It put some big fish in the boat. And I think that is important, especially on going north like that. As I said, I'm what I consider a forage-based angler. I want at least that forage-based, knowing what's in there, at least gives me an idea where to start. It may not be where I end up, but it's where I start.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. I love that. You mentioned there the, if there was any wind, you were throwing that skirted bait there. And if there was no wind, you're going to a more subtle, like a hair jig type presentation there. Why is that?
Okay, good. Great question. Usually on windier days, and I will, blade a jig is just one of those things I always have in a boat with me, whether it be for largemouth or smallmouth. Heck, I make my own big ones for northern pike. They love them. But wind has always been a contributing factor to that bait being more successful unless I'm close to grass. Okay.
Okay.
But in open water, I like, and if there's a little bit of stain on the water, I like throwing that bladed jig. I can cover water really good. Since I make my own, I can control what kind of vibration I want by either putting a size 2, 3, or 4 split ring on it. I can change the vibration of that bait. We could do a whole nother episode just on bladed jigs.
Oh, yeah. My wheels are spinning.
I can change the vibration and the action of the bait by changing the split rings as well as the size and the trailer. So anyway, so I like wind unless I'm around vegetation. I'll throw a bladed jig over the top of vegetation or in holes of vegetation whenever I can. If it's dead calm, especially for smallmouth like that, and you can see if they're not changing baits. I'm never going to try to force feed. I've tried it and it works. Try force feeding a fish a bait and they just don't want it. Yep. Well, you know, when they first hit it early in the morning, low light, that's fine. And all of a sudden I'm having follows to the boat. That's it. And all of a sudden they're darting off. They're not taking it. Okay. That means I got to change something. I don't always change color first. Usually I change depth of retrieve speed first. That's usually more important than color. But smallmouth, as you know, can be really picky on color. Really, really picky, like walleye sometimes. And so I'm like, this is just not working. So since it was dead calm and really hot and still, we noticed a bug hatch was going on. There was just a lot of bugs in the area. And I looked at my camera guy and I said, you know what? We got to start throwing that hair jig. We've been looking for a good hair jig bite, you know, all year. And we just haven't come across it yet. I mean, I was like 3 cast into it and she loads up. And yeah. And I'm like, okay, 3 casts later, loads up. Now I know what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like and that. Then we started figuring out where they were coming from. Mm-hmm. But in the morning or low light, and then later in the afternoon, when that's an early, late evening, when that sun would start setting, that low light condition, they could hone in. Because remember, especially smallmouth, they're sight feeders first. They could hone in on that bladed jig easier with that lower light. Or when it's windy, then they could. Also, it's a lot easier to control than that hair jig in the wind. I can't control a 1/16 ounce hair jig very good in the wind. But when it's dead calm, I can control it just fine.
Got it.
Okay. So there's two things. How can I be more efficient with my cast? And what can the fish see when they can see it better than they can the other bait? So there's a couple things that come into play there, but those are the two main baits. And so that last trip, that's how we would, you know, go between the two.
Sure. So that wind is really, you're looking at that wind is blowing across the surface of the lake. It's distorting the surface. It's creating chop. And then that is refracting less light or allowing less light through the surface. Got it. I hadn't thought about that. Easy, I always look directly just at the clarity of the water, but I mean,
easier for them to see and find that bait. My all-time favorite lure of all time, bar none, especially when it comes to smallmouth, X-Wrap size 10 hot pink.
I like that.
Hot pink. And I have caught more big smallmouth on that jerk bait when the water temperature is 55 and below.
Mm-hmm.
Really cold water temperature. You know, as a smallmouth guy, smallmouth can be triggered by really, really bright, obnoxious colors.
Yep.
And that pink, you know, and I've been asked the question 100 times, what do you think they think it looks like? I don't know, and I don't care. I don't care. I just know they eat it. So I don't need to know why all the time. Mm-hmm. I need to know when and where.
Yep. Absolutely.
Okay. And I know when is when that water temperature is below 55 degrees, and when you got pre-spawn, is that's really good for that. I've caught them after that on that too, but that mm-hmm. pre-spawn condition, especially in cold water, that X-Wrap is in everything from big muskies I've caught on that fishing for smallmouth, the big smallmouth, the largemouth. It's just, but smallmouth, that is just that. And I've got other X-Wraps and other jerk baits that I'll throw the rest of the year. But that cold water, that cold water like that, and you've got the water clarity for it, they just cream that thing. I don't care why. I just know what they do.
Yeah. I like that. You're the second. I just had Tony Peterson on a couple weeks ago. We were talking about fishing for smallies on the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And he also brought up the color pink in his flukes or whatever it may
yep.
be. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going up north. I'm going to be fishing some tannic water, that kind of stuff. Like, I'll tie a couple of pink streamers, just some Murdoch yeah. minnows, but just with a pink back. That'll be it. And they got crushed. And then I took them to the Wisconsin River last week and they got crushed. Like, I was fishing chartreuse and white and even silver and white. Picked up a couple as soon as I switched to pink. I mean, I had a fish eat literally boat side in our canoe while I was just trying to slap the fly in the water and just get it soaked so that it would sink faster on my next cast. And I had like a 14-inch smallmouth come just unglued right next to the boat and come up and just chow it. And I was like, maybe this pink is onto something. So
there's an episode we just released on Wired to Fish TV where we're catching them on is pink and white swim baits 2.8 and a pink and white mini bladed jig. And I mean, mm-hmm. it is pink. Crushed it. Absolutely just, and you couldn't even see the bait. It yep. was pretty awesome. Now, I don't know, but it stands out better. And we were fishing through reeds, a lot of reeds in shallow water. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt in my mind, they can see that wherever they're coming from, they can see that pink, that contrast of that pink and white coming through there a lot easier.
Right.
And I threw black ones and I threw other ones. We caught fish on that. But when you put that pink and white one back on, I just think they could see it from a greater distance.
Mm-hmm.
And when their bite window is bigger and they can see that bait, I've seen smallmouth, I'm sure you have, them come from 20, 30 feet away to literally crushed the thing, literally jumping a boat chasing the thing. So yeah, there's a lot to that.
Yeah, definitely. What makes you wonder too, just the whole pink theory, because like obviously in the Driftless we've got the pink squirrel is the mm-hmm. the famous little heard nymph that. And all that, and it's always like, okay, well, what, like, it doesn't really look like anything. Yeah. But it's just got this little pink collar. It looks kind of bushy. It could be a scud. It could be like, you know, sort of something a little caddisy, but not really. Like, I don't know, if you tie it skinny, it looks like a mayfly. But as long as it's got that pink, they seem to lock in on it. And like, I've heard theories of, as it gets further down in the water column, that red's the first color to get filtered out. And so maybe it turns the perfect shade of tan or gets some weird iridescence or what. I don't know. But
you just, I heard a diver tell me years ago, you just hit on it. The mm-hmm. deeper that pink gets, it almost gets a brown.
Yep.
Yeah. And what? Okay, I'll go for that.
Right.
You know, if that's why they're eating it, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. But that would make sense to me, because a lot of times, a lot of our baits are just a lighter or darker shade of gray. Is the mm-hmm. deeper they go, the only bait or the only color that retains its true color at any depth is lime green. See that Rapala right behind me up there?
Yeah.
What's the number one selling crankbait color of all time? It's Fire Tiger.
Oh, Fire Tiger. Yep. Exactly. I love it.
And that's so funny. Maybe that's just because they can see That, and if you look at deep diving crankbaits, most of the time, the most successful, whatever brand they are two-tone. And if you look at them, there are a lot of those brands that have that lime green somewhere, either on top or bottom of them. Maybe there is something to that.
Yeah, definitely. Let me ask you this. You touched on crayfish there and just on color right now. My wheels are spinning. I read a book by Mike Lawson called Spring Creeks, I think it was, or Fly Fishing in Spring Creeks, or all that. There was a bit in there, and to my knowledge, I haven't personally seen it, but he had a theory that if you see trout that are particularly colored up, like really, really vibrant, bright, bright colors, they've been eating scuds, and the omega-3s in the scuds are what give it that super iridescent, really vibrant, bright color. First time I've ever heard that theory. But I'm curious, as a guy who's caught a pile of smallmouth in both, you know, shad and, you know, baitfish fisheries and also crayfish fisheries, have you noticed a difference in the coloration or maybe even the markings of crayfish eating fish or smallmouth as opposed to baitfish eating fish?
That's a great question. And I have noticed, how can I say this? I've noticed when they're eating them, Lake of the Woods a couple of years ago, there's a huge, massive infestation on Lake of the Woods of rusty crayfish.
Yep.
Okay. And the smallmouth we were catching literally had rusty crayfish coming out of both ends. They were regurgitating them. My boat carpeting was disgusting.
Oh,
but,
I'm sure.
But we were catching, and we were throwing red crankbaits and red craw plastics. And we threw other ones too, and they touched them, but not nowhere near as much. But we were catching big walleyes in that area. We were catching big smallmouth in that area. And as much as they were regurgitating these crayfish, the bottom literally had to be crawling with them. It was the most insane thing I've ever seen, where hook coming up and they're throwing them up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were gorging themselves on them. Now, the only thing that I've noticed, back to your question, the only thing that I've noticed different-wise is sometimes I think on some of the bait fish, the fish seem to be stockier.
Okay.
Okay, like I'm going to go back to that trip we just had where Cisco's, you know, like these fish were really strong. I would suspect smallmouth, we all know, are strong anyway, but these fish fought like they were river fish, and they weren't. These are just lake fish, and they had so much power and so much energy. You know, a 4-pounder seemed like you were fighting in 5 or 6 minutes. You know, it might not have been that long, but it sure seemed that long. And they were just, they just seemed broader. You know, and compared to regular lake fish, where like on Mille Lacs, where I think pretty much they were feeding on, we think they're feeding on perch and crayfish because just in the areas that we caught them on. And I could be completely wrong on that. But when I know that baitfish is a major thing in there, especially like those Ciscos, those fish seemed a lot thicker to me for their size. They were shorter and thicker. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I wasn't sure, because we've all seen those smallmouth that get, you know, that real awesome war paint.
Oh,
and, you know, the striping down the side. They just look crazy looking. And then you get those other ones that are basically just kind of that all uniform brown or green kind of looking color. And it's like, it's still a cool smallmouth.
I do know, I love this, what I call the stripies, right? The war paint ones like that. But I know when you're fighting a fish like a Mille Lacs and you can see that fish out there and all you see is a dark brown spot in the water, that's a good one there, boy. That's a big one. That when it is dark brown, dark black, and that's all you can see is that shape out there, you're going, that's probably going to be over 4.
Yeah.
That's going to be a really, really good fish, you know? So yeah, that's just something that smallmouth guys get excited about, man.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's it.
Absolutely. Well, man, we're coming up on, you know, as this comes out, it's going to be the beginning of our end of June here. As we're, you know, heading into what can often feel like kind of the dog days of summer here. I was just talking with a gentleman earlier this morning about how we're getting spoiled right now, but we're a little worried that there's a storm coming of heat in July or August for us here. But as you start heading into this post-spawn, although if, you know, the trend continues, maybe it won't be fully post-spawn, but
till September, we don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
As we head into summer bass fishing here, where does your mind go in terms of what are you expecting the fish to do? And what are some of your top three ways to target bass?
We're gonna be chasing a lot more largemouth this summer because we've spent so much time filming earlier this year on smallmouth. So we're gonna be chasing a lot of largemouth. And so the number one thing that I can think that's going in a boat right away is a frog.
Yep.
That's frog is definitely going to be, it's going to be one of my best ways to cover water. It's a big fish bait. So, that a jig is always going to be in my boat. I have a jig in my boat from the beginning of the season till the last day that I step out. I love fishing a jig, whether it be a swim jig or a heavy cover jig. I just love fishing a jig. It's always productive and it's productive for big fish. The other thing I'm going to have with me without question, number three, is going to be a drop shot.
I like that.
And
you say it's a big fish bait. It's a big fish lure. Let me push back. What are things that are not big fish baits?
I don't know.
Or is it how you fish it more than
anything? Yeah, because I don't fish a spinner bait as much as I used to anymore. I used to fish them a lot, and they still work. But those are more to me of a fall bait anymore. And unless I'm fishing a river system, then I still have a spinner bait tie. I have a single spin that I tie all the time that I'll fish on a river system. But I'm going to be fishing a lot of lakes this summer. And so that frog is going to come more into play. A bladed jig, again, if it's windy. But then a regular jig, probably a wacky worm a little bit for sure, especially for fishing weed lines. But then to thoroughly cover an area and just get bit, no doubt is going to be a drop shot as well.
Sure.
Because where a drop shot may not catch a lot of big fish, although I've caught some pretty big fish on a drop shot, it's going to give me a better idea of what's in the area that I'm at. I may be able to pick off a couple big fish in a top water, or pitching a jig to weed lines and letting it fall down. But after I'm done with that, if that's been a productive area for me, I am not leaving that area without throwing a drop shot and going back over there to pick up any remaining fish. Cause that is just a technique that just flat out works. Any bass angler, largemouth or smallmouth, should, depending on the area of the country, should probably never be without a drop shot. That's just always a rig that is going to catch you something. It just gets bit.
For sure. Absolutely. Is there an order in which you, like, say you're going to a lake you've never been to before, you're going to prospect, right? You've got your frog, you've got your some sort of a jig in there, and then you've got your drop shot. Is there an order of operations you like to check things off in terms, do you like to start high and work low, start high? Is there specific types of structure you like to key in on right off the bat and then work out from? Or what's your exploration process like?
I've always been a visual guy, so I am going to alleviate and look at visual cover first. What does this lake offer me? Is there a lot of grass in it? Is there grass and laydowns? Is there grass and rock? Where do these two things meet? In other words, where is rock and sand meet? Where does the weed line end? Where does it start? I'm going to be looking for transition areas. And so with smallmouth, we know that's always a big thing. They love transitions, but so do largemouth. And so I'm going to be looking for that. Is there a shallow area of the lake in the summertime that I can fish shallow, but maybe has deep boat docks on it? Okay. Wisconsin and Minnesota, I'm always looking for lakes with boat docks on it. They got boat docks on it. I'm always going to have a place to start. Always. And then I'm probably going to broaden out from there. Okay. So they may not move up. If it's a sunny day, they may not really get on those boat docks till later in the day. Okay. If I find a good section of boat docks, is there a weed line 50 yards behind me that I'm missing that I need to go look at first? I need to get off that bank and go look. I know where they're going to go to when that sun gets high, at least some of them. Where are they coming from? That's what I need to go find then. And so early in the morning, I may start out with that bladed jig if it's windy or if it's cloudy. If it's still, I'm probably going to start out with a swim jig. And because that's always going to get bit. That's just a way I can cover a lot of water and come through just about everything. You know, and it'll come through all types of cover. And, you know, there are people out there that confuse cover and structure all the time. And there's guys in this industry that get paid a lot more money than I do that still can't figure out what the two are. And just for anybody listening, Structure is not a brush pile. Structure is not a boat dock. Structure is an irregular change in bottom contour. So structure is a point. It is a hump. It is a break. Okay? It's a change in the bottom. Cover is grass, is a brush pile, is lay down log. So I could be fishing structure like a point, and that could be good. If it's got one or two types of cover on it, it's probably going to be even better. It's going to up my odds of giving fish a reason to be there. And I just try to clarify that when I can, because I think it's confusing to new anglers. Mm-hmm. And because, well, am I fishing structure or am I fishing cover? Know the difference. There is a difference between the two. If I'm telling you I'm fishing structure, I'm probably fishing something offshore, or I'm fishing a change in the bottom somewhere. Okay. If I'm fishing cover, then chances are I'm going to be fishing shallow, you know, or unless I'm telling you I was fishing a point. So I'm fishing structure and there are brush piles on that point. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I'm fishing cover on top of structure. So, but when I first get to a lake, I'm looking for shallow cover that I can relate to first. Those I'm probably going to be picking off individual fish. When I find that, then I'm going to start looking maybe for some offshore structure to where maybe I can find groups of fish to make my day last longer.
For sure. Gosh, I love that breakdown of cover versus structure. It's the same thing. Like if you're looking at, you know, a deer property, it's habitat versus terrain, right? It's being able to differentiate the two and understanding they are not equal. One has to be a part of the other. Mm-hmm. That's so huge. I'm so glad that you just clarified that distinction there, because I think the majority of our listeners right now just went, sure.
And okay. you're gonna see people on TV do it all the time. You're gonna read somewhere on your phone, somebody do it all the time. Now you know the difference. So if you're confused, you can actually understand what they're saying. They may be saying it wrong, but now you can understand what they're saying. It makes it easier for you to go out and differentiate between the two.
Definitely. I love that just you mentioned in there, time of day plays a large factor in that too. Like they're not going to be under the boat dock right first thing in the morning necessarily. They might be, but they're probably going out to feed and then coming back to, it's kind of like that bed to feed pattern of whitetails, right? Like they're predatory fish. They're going to go find somewhere that they could eat when it is the safest for them to go and eat. And, you know, if you're sitting there fishing in their bedroom while waiting for them to come back, like you're not going to have a lot of luck.
One thing about rivers is current will always position fish. So you can find a school of fish really shallow in some cases on a river system because current will position those fish. On a lake and sometimes a natural lake, a lot of times on shallow cover, you're fishing for individual fish. Not all the time, but especially lakes that have a lot of pressure, a lot of boaters on them, you may get up to a boat dock and catch one fish off it. You may have a boat dock where there's six or seven, but realize chances are those fish are coming shallow for feeding opportunities, and you probably just pulled up when those fish were there. Because the one thing forward-facing sonar has definitely taught us is that fish don't sit still very long at all.
Right.
They are constantly, almost constantly moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just have to, and if you realize that, you know, when I start finding fish in certain areas, and a lot of times, like if I'm fishing boat docks, it could be the right post on a boat dock, for example. Then I'm going to see how many boat docks that I can find, say they're in 3 foot of water, that are close to deep water on the right side of that boat dock. And then, I'll make other casts to the other things and pick apart that dock, but I'm really going to concentrate on that one. If I start seeing that, then I'm not going to start wasting any time. Then I'm going to be going to the right side of those posts until things start to change. And I've really seen it where they have been on one area, and a lot of times it's because the sun positions them there.
Yep, for sure. Have you noticed in your fishing for bass, we're talking boat docks right here, I started getting in my head a little bit when I was up north this last time, where I just lost confidence fishing around boat docks, because in my mind, I was like, everyone and their grandkids stand out on that dock and they throw their, you know, bobber or slip bobbers, or they're throwing whatever they throw out there, and they're doing it whenever they have 5 minutes. If they're like me, they're just going to walk out, throw a couple casts, and then come back in. In my mind, the fish have seen it all. They're probably pretty pressured. You'll still find a couple, but they're not going to be as unpressured as they might be on that one shoreline where there's no cabins over there. It's all, you know, just natural deadfall or whatever it may be. Have you noticed any validity to that theory, or was I just in my head?
Well, yeah, every angler is different. I will tell you this. I don't mind because if somebody's casting out from their boat dock, especially if dad is there with their kids, I look for certain things on boat docks. I look for night lights. Okay, because sometimes they will turn on their night lights that will attract bait fish, and those bass could be conditioned to be around there anyway. Uh-huh. The other thing is, if I see a bunch of rods in a rod holder, chances are if there's crappies in that lake, there's going to be a brush pile somewhere around those things.
Sure.
Somewhere around that dock. So I pay attention to that too. I don't really worry. And obviously if somebody's out on the dock, I'm probably not going to make a cast up there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if they're coming down to the dock, hey, if they don't want me to fish it, that's fine. I got plenty of other docks. No big deal. I've really worked over the years on, I'm anal, the only way I can say it, about casting. Mm-hmm. I in my younger days when I had better sight, anyway, I would put quarters on the floor and pitch that jig to a quarter. And I still try to do that. I try to respect that homeowner as much. I know that dock is going to be a position that I'm going to have a chance to catch a fish in. And your first cast is going to be the most critical. You can catch them on the second or third, but your first cast is going to be the most critical. So I am already looking at the next dock while I'm fishing the one, thinking, where is that cast going to go? And what angle do I need to be, one, to get that bait in there without banging their boat or banging their boat dock? And two, what angle is going to give me the best opportunity to get that fish out of there where he's not wrapping me up around a dock post or a dock chain or anything like that? So there's a bunch of things. I got a lot of space left up here, dude. There's a lot of things that bounce off in there. and so I'm looking at that angle. And it's true. I'm always looking ahead and trying to figure out how that cast is, because I've pulled so many fish off docks and big ones off docks that it's just become a staple of being, I know we're going to start there. I want to build from there. But some days, you know, it could be a cold front. After a cold front on a natural lake or a reservoir, there's three places that, if we're just talking bass, are going to go: rocks, stumps, and docks. Yep. And so, you know, and if you've got natural lakes with grass lines, that's going to be a whole different light thing. I'm always going to fish grass first. But if you don't have that, rocks, stumps, and docks. And so I'm always going to look in those three areas. And docks have been so, so productive for me over the years that it's hard not to at least start there. So, and you know, early in the spring, sometimes a shallow boat dock will be the best. But I'm telling you, it doesn't matter if a dock has that much water on it. Eventually, sometime of the day, there's probably going to be a bass underneath it. They're going to come up and check for bluegills or check for something. So, you know, I've got different ways to approach docks with different baits, but it's always something that I look forward to fishing, because I know I am going specifically to a target that I know has a high opportunity of being a fish there. And once I figure out one or two bites on that dock, we're going to have a time. Mm-hmm. We're going to run it. We're going to run that, and we're going to figure out how to pull those fish off those docks. It's one of my favorite. If I could only fish for largemouth bass one way, it would be skipping a jig underneath the boat dock. Just hang on, dude. I'm back to 7 years old, hooting and hollering and having a ball. That's my absolute favorite way to catch largemouth, is yanking them out from underneath the boat dock. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, everybody's got that largemouth memory. Even if it's just one, it might not have even been the first one.
Yep.
But even if it's like a 10-inch fish, if it blows up on it, or like you pull it out from under there and you're like, oh, whoa, hold on a sec. I don't know that is. And then something about that just burns itself into your psyche. And you just can't get enough of it. That's awesome. Dude, you're dropping so much information right now. Just little tidbits here. I don't even know if you realize that you're doing it. I'm sure you do. But like, I am just lapping it up right now, man. This is fantastic.
I enjoy talking fishing, and you're a great host. So what else you want to talk about?
Dude, tell me about these urchin baits. I'd never heard of nor seen one. And then all of a sudden I was looking through your page and you were rigging one up, and I saw him while I was in Fleet Farm a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, what on earth is that? My initial thought was like, they're trying to copy the tequila, that dirty little, you know, streamer pattern. That's just a weird woolly bugger with massive legs. what the hell is this urchin thing supposed to imitate and how do you fish one?
Okay. So when, if you remember back to start, when the wacky worm first came out, and this was in the mid to late 90s, we all said that was the stupidest looking piece of plastic we ever saw. Man, was I wrong about that. I catch fish in that all over the place. One of my favorite baits to throw. It's a lot of fun. Then the Ned rig came out. And we went, now that's the stupidest looking piece of plastic. We were found out. And we caught fish in both freshwater and saltwater and numerous species of fish on the Ned rig. Then along came the urgent bait. It looked at the Ned rig and said, hold my beer. Because that is the dumbest looking. But you know what? And I got during seminar season this year, I got asked that question at just about every seminar. And the same thing is, what do you think it represents? And I'm going to go back to what I said earlier on your show. I don't care.
Yep.
I don't know. My thing is, what I have learned is, the slower the fall, that is, and there's, you know, you have dice baits, then you have your little urchin baits, and then you have now the big urchin. This thing is evolving faster than any, and the hooks, the way people are rigging it, it's all evolving faster. The bottom line is, it can be fished like two things. It can be fished like a wacky worm, and it can be fished like a jerk bait. Okay. And the thing is, when that thing is falling, it does next to nothing on a slow fall besides quiver a little bit. That's all it, what does a Ned rig do when it's on the bottom? It's doing nothing. It sits there. Yep. Remember, there are two things, and I was lucky enough years ago to, without getting into the story, the guy who invented the X-Wrap and a lot of the baits back then for Rapala was Mark Fisher. He's a Hall of Fame lure designer. And Fisher told me something that changed my jerkbait fishing, and I will say it in every seminar. The two most important things about jerkbait fishing is the pause and learning how to throw slack back to the lure. The pause is longer or shorter depending on the depth of, depending on the temperature of the water. Okay? That's why that pause is important. Throwing slack back to that lure allows that lure to go off on its intended path. If more people would do that with crankbaits and jerkbaits, you would up your ratio of catches. If you talk to Jeremy Smith from Linder's Angling Edge, who I highly respect and is a great guy in his own right and an incredible angler, him and I were talking about jerkbaits on my show one time, and he said, Jim, if people realize how important those two things were, throwing slack back to the lure and understanding the pause, two things have to happen every time you catch a fish. You have to attract them and you have to trigger them. You will not catch a fish without both those things happen. What is that pause? That pause is what that urchin's doing on the fall. It's doing nothing. It's doing nothing. That nothing is a trigger because it's the beginning before it starts to do something. It is the pause of a regular action. That pause, in my opinion, is what draws strikes on jerkbaits. When you pause a crankbait, when you throw a spinnerbait up to something, when you're taking that fly and ripping it, stripping it, and pausing it, when do you get a strike a lot of times? On that pause. That doing nothing has been personified in that urchin bait.
I like it. That
bait does nothing. Stop trying to make it do something. The best thing you can do with a hair jig is nothing. You reel it back in as slow as you possibly can. The more you jig it, hop it, try to do something that you think it should do, the less fish you catch on.
Yep.
The urchin, wacky worm is the same way. The more you do with it, the less fish you will catch on it. Do the same thing with the urchin bait. Yeah, is it something they haven't seen before? Yeah. Could it resemble something that they're eating? Probably could. But when it comes right down to it, the how you retrieve it, the magic in that bait is not the bait itself. The magic in that bait is what the angler does or does not do with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's counterintuitive. People get scared of the pause. They need to get over the psychological hurdle because they're worried about, I'm going to snag on the bottom or I'm not going to feel that fish. Because we've all been there where you set the rod down or something happens and, oh, here it's doing nothing, like you said.
Why is my line moving?
And then
you
pick it back up. Yep, yeah. You pick it back up and then it's like, oh, wait, oh, I had one and I lost it. Shoot. And then we think, oh, well, I need to stay really tight to it. I need to stay like, and that's what, if you're thinking that way, so is everybody else, right? You got to be doing, it's like, I mean, like anything, if you want to trick the smartest fish in the lake or in the river, like you got to do things that other people aren't willing to do. And a lot of times it's perfecting that finesse and it's doing the little stuff like you said, like, you know, trying to hit a quarter with your cast. It's in the precision.
Fish, Yeah, fish don't think. People give them human traits. Stop doing that. They do three things. They swim, they eat, they make little fish. That's all they do.
Yep.
And they survive for as long as they've survived because they react to their environment. And if they think something's food, it doesn't matter what we think it is. It doesn't matter what we think it looks like. All it matters is, do they hit it or not?
Yep.
And if they hit it or not, a lot of times depends on the depth you have that lure at and the retrieve speed that you have that lure at. How are you presenting that lure? I was talking to Justin Lucas, MLF pro Justin Lucas, who's an absolutely fantastic guy, a couple weeks ago. And I was watching him do the retrieve on that big urchin bait in a tournament, another tournament he just did real well in. And so we talked about how he did good on it. He said, I threw it out there and he said, I just pulled it. He goes, I was working like a jerkbait because guys had told me that's kind of what they were doing. And he goes, but I came across this thing in his pocket where I threw that thing in there, let it sink there, rip it hard twice and let it sink. I go to rip it again and I already had it.
Yeah.
He goes, so the thing would pulse, nothing. Pulse, nothing. When did they hit it? Nothing.
Nothing. Yep.
Exactly. They hit it on the nothing. And I've told guys this, when I threw the little dice baits on a drop shot, when I rigged them on a drop shot, I would sit there and I would shake the rod tip and hit my finger in a rod tip. And how I learned to do that is I put the bait in shallow water and I watched it when I'm hitting my rod tip and I'm watching those strands pulse. So when I drag that drop shot on the bottom, when I'd stop it, I do that. All of a sudden, line got tight.
Yep.
Just as that bait was pulsing. And then I'd stop, pulse it again, boom, and a rod go down.
Yep. And that's something that's so that's such a great tip. And it's something that too few people actually do, is watch what their lure or what their fly does at their feet so that they know exactly how quickly that thing sinks or exactly how reactive that is. If I just twitch my rod tip or do that little tap with the finger there and that whole thing's like just pulsing like crazy. Okay, now I know I don't need to do a whole lot to move that urchin or whatever it is, you know? And it's,
there's a couple things. And I tell this at every seminar, I ask a question to a guy or to the audience every time. How many of you, by a show of hands, know exactly what your lures are doing on every single cast? 9 times out of 10, no hands call. I go, then you're missing fish.
Mm-hmm.
If you have, and you're missing opportunities. If you don't know what your lure is doing on every single cast, you are not fishing. You are hoping for a bite. You are wasting time.
Yep.
Understand what your lure does. You know, you understand it by watching it in shallow water. Understand and learn what that lure is capable. All it is a tool. There are no magic lures out there. The magic, in my opinion, is in the presentation and the location of the fish.
Yep. The best color is confidence, right?
That's right. And green pumpkin. I will throw any color out there as long as it's green pumpkin. Yep. Right? It works. It's just one of those colors. So if you're learning a newer bait, like if you're learning to throw an urchin bait, throw a color you already have confidence in. Mm-hmm. Because you already are a step ahead. Now you go, I catch a lot of colors on black and blue. Then throw a black and blue urchin. If you have a lot of confidence in green pumpkin, and throw a green pumpkin one. You will work that bait with more consistency off to start off because you have confidence in that color. Don't put yourself in a hole and go, I got to throw Wonder Bread. Have you ever caught anything on Wonder Bread? No, then don't start throwing it.
Yeah.
Work on that after you get confidence in the lure. But if you have confidence in green pumpkin, start out doing it with that.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've seen so far, the urchin baits and dice baits, the less you do with them, the more. And for whatever reason, that jerk ahead and fall, I was just watching Jason Christie, who just won a tournament, just pitch it to cypress trees. Cypress trees. Pull off cypress tree, let it sink. Pull it off, let it sink. Pull, boom, and there's a fish.
Yep.
So that is a lot of the retrieve. I've also seen how I've caught them is throw the bait in there, let it sink down there, and just kind of shake my rod a little bit, and you're making the bait just pulse, and then just let it fall. So I'd say, in my opinion, you can fish it like a wacky worm too, but that jerk bait retrieve is how it seems has been the most productive with that, unless you're looking at it forward-facing sonar. And I'm not. I'm just throwing it shallow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally. Well, part of it too, I always feel like, at least in my mind, it's you put out those two jerks and like that's vibration that's going into the water, right? So even if they can, maybe they can't see, maybe they're looking the other way, but they're going to feel that,
right?
At some point. And then give them that pause to come and find it. You know what I mean? Like I'll tell my clients, like, just give it the super pause, like an extra 2 seconds beyond what you think you need to do. And weird. Line goes tight and it just happens, you know? Like, let the fish find it. Let them get there. Don't have it run too much.
Now, the smaller urchin baits, like the, you know, like the little super ball baits, those ones right there, the small ones, I just rigged those on a net head. Ooh. And I throw it on a, I throw it on a 16th ounce net head, pitch it out and let it fall to the bottom. And I work it on the bottom just like a net rig.
Huh.
Works.
That just has to look gross.
It's weird. It just looks like a little thing going, it looks like a little crab or something going across the bottom.
I'm sure it looks awful crayfishy. Yeah. Especially when that thing kind of just, if it kicks up and then sits there and quivers. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I like that.
It's just another way to do something. If I've caught them in the area on a net rig or I just want to throw something smaller, I'm going to try that.
Definitely. I love it, man. I absolutely love it. Well, dude, we've been going for over an hour here. I want to be respectful of your time. Before we wrap up here, though, I got two final questions for you here. The first one, I've been asking this to everyone this summer. What is the coolest non-fishing thing you've seen while fishing?
The coolest non-fishing thing that I've seen. Wow, that's a great question. I don't... I know one first thing came to mind was a Canada trip, and I looked around and there was a bear swimming at the boat. Yeah.
Yeesh.
Yeah, that was... We need to move. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was just coming right. It was just a younger bear, not a real big one, 100 pound or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he was coming right toward the boat. I'm like, that's not something you see every day in Illinois. And we just moved. So yeah, that was one of the things that right off the bat that I think that was pretty cool.
That's super cool. Yeah, it's fantastic. That's the coolest part of like doing anything outside though, right?
Yeah.
It's like regardless of what you're pursuing, you're going to see something else that was like, I would not have seen that had I not been doing this one thing. I love that. I love hearing what sticks out and what memories are burned in people's mind in that regard, man. That's super, super cool. I love it. What do you have lined up for the rest of this summer? You mentioned that you got most of your filming done, but where else are you headed?
We're heading up to Minnesota another week or so, and we'll probably get two or three shows up there. Then we're going to be almost done. I'm going to fish a little bit around here, and then end of September, we're going to Lake of the Woods, a lodge, Shady Roost that we fish up there, mm-hmm. probably for muskies. Nice. We'll probably do a late fall trip there. And then I am going, to Brazil to fish peacock bass.
Well, that'll just be terrible.
That'll be terrible. And so I actually just finished building two of the three rods that I'm going to be taking, to Brazil with me. Cause I want to catch a peacock bass on a rod that I made.
Sweet.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So I've caught them in Miami and they were fun, you know, the smaller ones, but I've got a really good friend who's from Brazil and he goes, you need to do this. So we're going to go after those peacocks and we're going to go after some of those really big catfish that they have there, knock like three or four fish off my bucket list. So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's going to be a really cool adventure.
That's going to be epic. That's going to be absolutely epic, dude. I'm excited for you. And like you said, we barely scratched the surface here. We just, we've been nerding out on all this other stuff. And like you said, we got so much space in our heads that's
I'm a nerd when it comes to fishing, lure building, rod building. I'm a nerd I like to know how my stuff works. And that's why,
absolutely.
You know, I build a lot of my own stuff. I love it. And, anytime, man, anytime you're looking to nerd out some more, give me a buzz.
Absolutely. We're definitely going to have you on to talk lure building and rod building and everything sometime in the near future. But before we wrap up, man, where can folks go to follow along with you and check out all the new episodes that are coming out and just keep up with your season?
Thanks for asking. The easiest way to do it is just go to jimcrowleyoutdoors.com. Our entire television schedule is there for both Jim Crowley Outdoors and Slick Fish Radio. So you can see everything there. And then you can follow along on my social media, which is Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. And kind of like I told you in the beginning, if there's any parents listening here. Yeah, I talk to a lot, very fortunate to talk to a lot of high school students and college students when it comes to fishing as well. And you're only going to find three things on my social media pages. You're going to find anything to do with fishing, about rod building or lure building, and you're going to hear me talk and profess my faith in Jesus Christ. That is it. All my pages are safe. If those things don't interest you, my pages isn't the one to follow. But if they are, they're totally safe for kids. And all we try to do is put out good, solid information. Like I told you before, I don't care if people agree with me or disagree with me. I just want them catching more fish. And being here with you and talking today, hopefully we got some people excited and that share the same passion that we do. And I sure appreciate the opportunity, Pierce.
Absolutely, Jim. I really appreciate your time. This was an absolute blast. I'm definitely looking forward to the next time we get a chance to chat. And if you find yourself making your way up through Wisconsin at all, maybe we'll have to kill an afternoon or something harassing some fish if we can find time.
But, oh, well, geez, I love coming to Wisconsin. I'm there a lot during the year, so we might just have to make that happen. But God bless you, your family, and all your listeners. I truly appreciate the opportunity.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Jim. Good luck the rest of the summer. We'll talk to you soon.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.